apologies on the front end, everybody. The Big Suey is already out. It was not my intention to double up your daily dose of Mike Ryan. I'm sorry about that. Believe me, no one is more cognizant of how annoying I can be than myself. But the Carlos Dunlap trade broke while I was recording with Mina. I was going for something a little bit more evergreen, so here we are. Now the local hour, after the Big Suey. But we welcome in David Samson, and you guys like David Samson. So once again, I'll be the most disliked person in the Zoom. The odd time that David Samson's one of the more likable characters. David, I want to talk to you about something that is on everybody's mind. It's Halloween this weekend. Granted, it's a different Halloween than I think any of us are used to, but many people are trying to get in the mood watching good, scary movies. And I've discovered something in browsing all these streaming platforms for a good, scary movie that's been made recently. There aren't any. What is, to David Samson, the best scary movie of the last couple of years?
I think you know me well by now, and this is a terrible setup, but it shows we don't rehearse. I don't watch scary movies. Ever.
No psychological thrillers.
Well, would you say Shutter Island is a scary movie to you?
I would say that that's a psychological thriller. I would say that The Sixth Sense is a psychological thriller. There are good psychological thrillers out there that would fit the theme of getting ready for the holiday, Halloween. So what to you, is Shutter Island really the best movie of recent year? When did that come out? I think that came out like 8 years ago.
I don't know why that was in my head, but I don't view psychological thrillers as scary movies. Scary movies to me are like the Blair Witch Project, where there is no purpose to the movie other than to scare you. I also don't like movies where it's the music that gets you to be scared and then there's no delivery on the fear. So I used to, what happened was in the old days, I would watch movies and I would be willing to be scared by music only if I got the scouting report in advance that the music didn't lead to anything actually scary. When you grow up in New York, as I did, and you're a scared kid, as I was always a small paranoid kid. My recurring nightmare before I went to college and had the recurring nightmare that I slept through the final exam and failed and had to go to summer school is that I lived on the 14th floor in New York City, and I had a window that had a ledge on it, and I could never open my window because I wouldn't open my window. But I always thought parachutists were going to land on my ledge and kidnap me. And so I had this amazing fear always of just, I was always scared. I never walked on side streets in New York City. I only walked on the large two-way streets like 72nd Street and 79th Street and 86th Street. And it has lasted my entire life, I'm sorry to say. Here I am in my second half century, and I'm not about to change now.
Kidnapping is a natural fear, especially for any young child. But what does the parachute mean? Have you delved into why that was a recurring fear? Specifically, someone parachuting in to kidnap you?
Well, it started with, because I've always been a logical, this is actually quite funny and really has been delved into deeply in therapy. But when there's a ledge outside your window, to me, it was the only logical way that someone could break into my room and take me. There was no other way. You couldn't catapult from the top of the building. You couldn't climb up the building like Spider-Man. But I thought it was very reasonable that someone in a parachute could land on that ledge and then get through the window, take me, and then continue on with the parachute down to the bottom of the apartment building where I grew up. It all made perfect sense to me, which is funny how the mind works when you're young. But as I've gotten older, it hasn't changed, because I look back at my young self thinking these things and I don't find them to be that out of the ordinary.
So you don't have a recommendation for me. So I'll put this out to the audience. I don't like the crazy jump scares because I find that to be gratuitous. I don't need to be watching a scene with one hand over my ears just because the music's going to get loud and scare me. It's a cheap scare. I want something that stays with me. I saw this movie yesterday on Netflix called The Girl on the Third Floor because I Googled best scary movies of 2019 to see if any good scary movie was made recently. And I landed on one that stars the former WWE wrestler CM Punk. And it was, I think, an 84 on Rotten Tomatoes. I'm like, this has got to be good. Wasn't good at all. CM Punk, I thought you'd be a good actor, not a good actor.
Do you search for the feeling that you get? Like, do you crave that, the feeling you get when you're uncomfortable and scared? Is that why you want to watch it?
Not particularly. I don't like jump scares. I don't like feeling being made to feel that way because I think it's kind of a cheap theatrical experience too. I like, you know, Get Out, that Us. Those are movies. They have some of those jump scares, but movies that what's actually happening is the tense thing, not someone just out to boo surprise you. I think that's cheap. The Exorcist, something that messes with your mind, not something that is just, I mean, superficial and you forget like that.
So Get Out is a great example. I saw that movie because I'll watch anything with Bradley Whitford in it. And I enjoyed it very much, but I didn't like the fact that there were some parts of the movie where it was clear that I was watching through my, you know, when you put your hand over your face and you just spread your fingers small enough that you can see a little tiny bit through, but you're sort of closing your
eyes.
You
still do that?
I watched part of Get Out that way.
You still do that. What about slasher films, David? Obviously, you don't watch scary movies, but when you were a teenager, did you ever watch the Halloween franchise? I would love to talk to you about who the greatest movie horror villain is, the best slasher, because I'm a Freddy Krueger guy myself.
So I haven't seen one Halloween movie. I haven't seen one Friday the 13th movie. Those are the exact thing that we've been talking about for the last 10 minutes.
Yeah.
There's zero chance I would watch those things because to me, that wasn't a movie. That was a likely event in my life that could happen.
All right.
So why would I watch something to give me like a preview of something bad that was going to happen to me?
Nightmare on Elm Street. If I could just tout the merits of Freddy Krueger, while it's your cheap, you know, teen slasher film, there's actually something to it because what are teenagers afraid of? The dark, and when they go to sleep, they're worried that the boogeyman's going to get them. This is a boogeyman that attacks you specifically while you're sleeping. So it has a psychological element to it. Freddy Krueger stayed with a lot of people in ways that maybe Jason Voorhees, who's a little bit more, you know, different, although so as
a little
ridiculous.
A little nugget for you is that I've always been scared of the dark, and I slept with full lights on until about 2 years ago. And I finally was able to work through, and this sounds, I can't believe it's even worth talking about on this show, but I will. It was an amazing accomplishment to me to turn the lights out and sleep in the dark. And I don't mean just one light on. I used to sleep with all the lights on.
Wow.
Because I assumed when the lights were off that someone was going to come get me. And every time I heard a little noise, I would wake up, and I still do that. But I am now in the dark, so I got over that fear. It's really an unbelievably paralyzing fear to be scared of the dark, and it impacts your eyes because my eyes never adjusted the way I think a regular person's eyes adjust once it gets dark. To me, it was always pitch black if I were ever in the dark, and so it's not that I'd keep a closet light on. I'm talking about overhead lights, well, any light possible is how I would go to sleep.
Like you're in a doctor's office or something, that bright white light. How does this go over with your partners?
So it's an interesting thing. When I am alone, it's more important. When I'm not alone, over the years, I'm able to have lights on, that it's sort of a compromise situation. But when I spent most of my life in a hotel and alone, and there would be all the lights on. And now I'm able to go in a hotel and have the lights out. I also used to never close the door. That's another thing that was a big issue of mine as a kid. My door would never be closed, including as a teenage boy.
Really?
So if you can understand the difficulty in privacy, because I would never want a door closed because that would scare me as well. And now I've gotten past that. And this is all in the last 2 years only. I've gotten past that. And now I actually sleep with the door closed.
Well, I'm happy for you that you worked through that. Look, we spent probably a little too much time on horror movies. And while I enjoyed our most recent episode, major mistake by me, I didn't address the Mike Hill situation with you. Now, you foretold this situation. You told us time in and time out that Derek Jeter is going to make Mike Hill an offer he can refuse, and Mike Hill would more than likely be on his way. Your reaction to Mike Hill and the Marlins parting ways?
Well, the minute Derek Jeter bought the Marlins was the countdown for anyone who worked with me to leave the team. It was just a matter of when their contracts were up. Mike Hill had 3 years left when Jeter took over, so Mike Hill was going to have 3 years left. What Jeter did is he took all of the information he could from Mike Hill. He used all of Mike Hill's ability to run a business and baseball organization, And when his 3 years were up, Jeter felt as though his training wheels were off and he can run the team on his own now. It'll be very interesting to see who they hire to replace him. I would tell you that they're not going to hire a strong-willed, big-time executive. They're going to save the money for sure. And he's going to work with the person really he's been working with this whole time, whose name is Gary Denbo. And so the only thing I took issue with is how it happened. It's the same thing with getting rid of Andre Dawson and Jeff Conine and Jack McKeon and Tony Perez. If you don't want them and you want to bring in your own guys, just stand up, take the camera and say, those guys worked with David. I want to bring in George Posada or Andy Pettit or whoever are my guys. I want, if you're not a Yankee, I don't want you. And I'm the CEO and that's my decision. People misunderstand me, Mikey. I'm totally fine with Derek Jeter doing whatever he wants, but just stand up and say it. And he never did it. And so he does something to Mike Hill that Mike Hill didn't deserve, especially after this year. Now, Derek Jeter can claim he made all the decisions on which players they were getting back in the draft, in the trades, but that's not true. He can say that he did everything to improve the team, but we know that's not true. But what he can't say is that he's the one who understands how to be a GM and all the things that are required administratively, all the things that are required to know the rules. If you ask Derek Jeter as a player, I don't blame him. There's no players who know the rules. I spent more time in a clubhouse talking to players about the rules of options and the rules of the DL and the rules of the per diem, all the different things that are just rules. They just don't know, because they don't care. Their focus is on the field. And that's the role that Mike Hill played. And now he's gone and he's going to get another job because he deserves to get another job. And I think that he will finally see what, he defended Jeter a lot to me over the 3 years, saying, you know, he just doesn't like you, David. That's why, you know, you feel this way about him. But I'm telling you, it's totally different now. And I think that Mike now realizes that Jeter's Jeter.
Any insight as to what the offer was? Was it an insulting offer?
See, it's funny you say insulting, because
I don't want you to betray a confidence, David.
I would never betray my kill. But what I will tell you is what is one man's insulting is another man's end of the rainbow. Oh my God, it's Lucky Charms. This is the greatest offer in the history of the world. So it's very difficult. It's like when a major league player says, I am insulted by getting a 3-year deal at $12 million a year, right? That's a very tough word to use. So I think you should, what a better word and a better question, if I could be so bold, was it an offer commensurate with his experience as a president of baseball operations?
Wordy.
How about that?
Wordy, not as catchy.
All right, ask me it a different way than insulting, because that's a tough word.
Given this most recent season and how the Marlins are on an upward trajectory, easy for me to say, was the offer fair?
No.
It was an unfair offer. There we go.
It was not even in the neighborhood of fair. It was not even in the same zip code of fair. They couldn't see fair from there.
Interesting.
It was done for the sole purpose of being able to say publicly that we made an offer.
All right.
That's it. Because it's not a good look for them to let go Mike Hill, to let go a black president of baseball operations. It's just not a good look for baseball. It's not a good look for Jeter. And so there had to be an offer made. I ask you, was offering Andre Dawson $25,000 to be and not allow him in the clubhouse and not allow him in spring training and tell him he can make a few community events and not allowed in the owner's suite during games, not having a place to watch, is that a fair deal? You'd say, well, $25,000, that's not nothing. I get that.
Yeah.
But I would say that's not a fair deal.
Understood. I guess it's in line with what you made once before, what other luminaries are making, what exactly the lift is for you. Joe, sports fan, can't really relate to that. So I understand where you're coming from. You mentioned that Mike Hill is going to get another job. So it's at least good to see that what happened to Larry Beinfest, and you explained to us in a previous episode that the reason why Larry Beinfest never really caught on anywhere else to the same executive level was because Jeffrey Loria was kind of talking smack about him, and owners think kind of like Jeffrey in that, hey, if you want someone to go along with your every word, Larry Beinfest isn't the guy for you.
So I don't know that I said talking smack, but I did say certainly owners do have a say when they speak to other owners. But the other thing that Larry didn't do that he should have, he was only willing to take the top job. And very often when you lose your job at the top, you take a special assistant job and then work your way when there's an opening. The reason why Mike Hill won't have to do that is that there's an opening in Los Angeles with the Angels right now. And God knows he's got experience working with owners like Artie Moreno. Two, there's an opening in Philadelphia right now. And John Middleton is tough to work with, but fair and good. Three, Steve Cohen is going to make an opening with the New York Mets. I promise you that. And then the Cincinnati job is no longer open. So there's three openings as of right now. And I think it's safe to say that Mike Hill is at the top of every one of those lists. And it's going to be interesting for the Marlins because they're going to realize going forward what role Mike Hill played. And he's not irreplaceable. None of us is irreplaceable. Yeah. The question is, who will they have in that front office to do the work that Mike did? Because most of what president of baseball operations do, contrary to what those people think who are not in baseball, it's not very sexy at all, at all.
Very media savvy of you, and I should be better as an interviewer. I was just, for our audience, boiling down what you said as talking smack, but that's not exactly how you framed it, and you're very cognizant of not being aggregated. Good on you. I'll be better. Let's talk about what happened with the World Series. Rob Manfred got lucky. Lucky. I mean, as lucky as you can be with a positive test impacting Game 6 the way that it did, but he's lucky the Dodgers bullpen held on to that lead and there was no Game 7 because God only knows what would have happened. Let's talk about that in a little bit, but let's talk about what actually happened. Justin Turner getting a positive result within a bubble, which is counterintuitive.
Not
to
a bubble. First of all, it wasn't a bubble.
It's just a neutral site.
They called it a bubble. That's like me calling myself tall.
Yeah.
I'm tall compared to a 3-year-old.
It wasn't a bubble. It was just a neutral site.
That's all it was. The players went from the ballpark to the hotel to the ballpark to the hotel. But it's not a bubble when there are 11,000 fans in the stands. It's not a bubble when you have allowed people and families in without following the full quarantine rules. You just haven't. They quarantined for a period of time, but it was not like the NBA bubble, not even remotely. But you also said a word that I think you should check at the door. You said that the Justin Turner positive test impacted Game 6. How did it impact Game 6? That's the whole point. It didn't, because they let him play.
How does that happen? How are we getting test results in the middle of games? How does that happen?
So here's how it worked during the regular season when MLB didn't care as much about postponing a game or changing the schedule because there was not a lot of money at stake. During the postseason, any tiny change to the schedule of a postseason game will impact what the make good will be to the broadcast partner, which means that if broadcast partner Fox pays $1 million, and it's way more, $1 million to broadcast a game, they are broadcasting that game on a Tuesday night at 8:09. That's the deal. If it has to be Tuesday night at 11:09, not because of a rain delay, that's impactful. If it has to be moved to Thursday, how's that going to work when there's Thursday night football? So you couldn't delay Game 7 or Game 6 to Thursday. Baseball's very aware of this situation going in. They got this test back, and they've got some splaining to do to me because they got the test back. They were testing every day. And in the regular season, if there's a positive test, the game is postponed. Hard stop. They didn't do it with the Marlins. And then all of a sudden they realized they better start doing it. So they did. But postponing a playoff game is something they did not want to do. And no one asked MLB that question. And I don't understand how they got away with that, because MLB is now focused in what's the word when you focus on something else so people don't look at the mole on your face, so you make them focus on something else?
Well, a distraction. Let's call it play action.
Okay. The play action was focusing on Justin Turner coming onto the field after the game. That's the play action. That's the statement that MLB made. And that, to me, did not pass the smell test. I want to know why, when you got an inconclusive test Monday, that you didn't hold off on Tuesday's game until you got the test back, because the answer they would have given is, we couldn't do it because of money. And that's okay. But just say it.
He learned about this test, this positive test result, in which inning?
So what they're trying to say is that the positive test, which was taken after the inconclusive test, came back in the second inning. Then they're trying to say it took till the sixth inning to speak to Andrew Friedman. And then they're trying to say it took to the eighth inning to pull him out of the game. And I've been to thousands of games, and I know that I can get down to the clubhouse myself in 35 seconds. That's how long it would take me to get information. And here's another little nugget. Rob Manfred was at the game, and so was Dan Hallam, and so were all the top lieutenants at baseball. Therefore, when they get the call in the second inning, they could have gone down right then and there and gotten it done. But what happened was it took them four innings to figure out what to do, because they had to decide what to do. Then they had to call the players union to tell them what they were going to do. And that's what took the time. But here's another little nugget. The head of the players union is at the game also.
Oh, wow.
Everyone is there. So what took four innings? And in baseball, four innings, that's like 2 hours.
That's incredible. I was frustrated. That is that. Incredible. You certainly know the inner workings of that. We were just all kind of idiots wondering aloud, how does this happen? We didn't know about I certainly didn't know about the second inning result. That is a major, major F up by everyone involved. Were they just hoping that the Dodgers would win and they didn't have to worry about it? Is that what they were rooting for?
So they knew they had to pull Turner from the game. The question was, how long did it take them to communicate that? And what they're going to say is that they weighed everything. Do they remove him from the game? Do they not? But it's not a question. That's part of the protocol. And what MLB was doing is saying Justin Turner violated protocols by going back on the field when he was told not to. And so the total.
They're trying to make that the story. They're trying to deflect to that.
The deflection was the word I was thinking of. That is what they're making the story. For me, the big story is, why did they play the game after the inconclusive test? You've got to know that there's going to be a positive test.
Wow.
Now, could it be a false positive? Because the rest of the Dodgers purportedly all tested negative and were then allowed to fly back to LA last night.
I don't get that. There's an incubation period for this virus.
That's the point, Mikey, and that's what's so unreal. Of course, it's very likely that many of them will test negative, if not all of them. But now, do you test them all again today, tomorrow? No, it's the off season.
They were just hoping for the Dodgers to win and make the decision for them. They didn't want to. So the protocol is you end the game immediately if there is a positive test, right?
No, because it never happened. The protocol is you don't start the game if there's the possibility of an inconclusive or a positive test.
So there's nothing written in the protocol as if a positive test comes midway through a game?
No. That's why they had to decide.
They should have stopped the game, though. They should have stopped the game.
Either you stop the game or you pull Justin Turner and hold and cross your fingers. Is it a coincidence that the Dodgers got to Blake Snell, had a 3-1 lead, and then Justin Turner is told to be pulled from the game? I'm just throwing it out there because it was the eighth inning. And to me, if you're watching that game as a baseball executive, that game was over once Nick Anderson gave up the double to Mookie Betts. Because we've been around enough games that we've seen how that happens. And all the air came out of the Tampa, I was going to say the Devil Rays, all the air came out of the Rays' sails. You just had that feeling that you knew it was going to happen. So I would argue that it was there some sort of nefarious intent? I don't know. It's frustrating because you're right. If there had been a game seven, by the way, it would not have been last night. That I can promise you.
Which is why they were hoping that the Dodgers would take care of business. All right. Since you brought it up, there would be no game seven the day after. We'd have everything to figure out. Obviously, Turner not going to be available for the remainder of that series, unless it comes out that it's a false positive. But how many false positives do you need? More than one. You need multiple. You need multiple negative test results before you're cleared back for action. What's the waiting period on that? I'm sorry.
So baseball was saying that if you can get two negatives within a 24-hour period, outside of a 24-hour period, so you take one one day, you take one the next day, and if you're without symptoms and you get two negative tests, then they would consider the one positive a false positive, which changed from the beginning of the season. Do you remember Juan Soto, that great player for the Nationals?
Yes.
I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
One of the best young players in baseball. He didn't start the season with the Nationals, and that really hurt them because he had a positive test, and he kept getting positive tests, but it turns out they were false positives.
Yeah, that also happened with the Pirates reliever Killa, I think is his name. He just couldn't get a negative test result. He had gone months.
It also
months.
Happened with two of the Reds players as
yeah.
well.
He went months not having symptoms, but he kept getting positive test results. The virus stayed in his system longer. It's one of those inexplicable things. I think the Jaguars have a really scary case right now. It's not a sexy name. It was a rookie running back of theirs. He's been hospitalized twice by the virus. He's been on the COVID-19 list since the start of training camp, and it's a very concerning thing. He's not remotely close to coming out of this thing, it would appear. So, interesting, to say the least. The stuff that was all over Good Morning America was Justin Turner on the field celebrating with his teammates. The unfortunate photo of him right next to, they didn't even have the presence of mind to keep him away from cancer survivor Dave Roberts. He's right next to him, maskless, or at least with a chin diaper thing, for the team photo right next to the manager. You've done the hard thing already, which is take Justin Turner out. How does he make his way back on the field?
Well, so the Dodgers were not very helpful here because you heard Mookie Betts give his quote, hey, he's going to celebrate with us because he's a big part of the team. You heard Corey Seager saying, hey, you know, I don't feel comfortable with him not being able to be with us celebrating. And even Andrew Friedman comes out and says, you know what? We're all together in this contact tracing because we've been together for so long. So really, what's the difference? Though I understand optically it doesn't look good. But what didn't come out until later in the day is how emphatically, and that's the word used by Major League Baseball, how emphatically MLB security, the union, and MLB tried to get Turner not to celebrate. And I get it. I've been there. Do you know when we won the World Series in 2003, a lot of people rushed the field. A lot of non-uniform personnel went on the field to be part of the dog pile. I went straight into the clubhouse and did a small celebration with Jack and Larry and Mike and Dan Jennings.
In a previous episode, you also told us that you were balancing marital dynamics during a divorce.
It's yes, but that had nothing to do with not going on the field. I left that for the players. But the reality was that there's plenty of ability to celebrate in the clubhouse. That's where the fun celebration is, with the champagne, with the goggles, which we didn't have because why would you ever use goggles? I came up with a line on CBS Sports HQ because I was talking to Will Middlebrooks, who won a World Series with the Red Sox in 2013, and we were on the air, and he said when he won the World Series, he loved having the goggles on because he said champagne stings your eyes so much that it's uncomfortable. And that to me is the fun of a celebration. And I said to him, if you can't stand the sting, you don't deserve the ring. But it turns out that everybody's such a wussy these days. They wear these goggles. But the point is, there's plenty of time to celebrate in the clubhouse when no one's around watching. You let the media in. You let them see the celebration. You kick the media out. And then that's when it gets serious. When the media left our celebration in New York, in the Yankee Stadium, that's when things got a little wacky. That's when you're shotgunning beers. That's when you're doing stuff and you're seeing players do things, you know, showing off their bodies and all sorts of things that generally are not done on camera. And Justin Turner could have participated in that, and he would have avoided this whole issue.
So how does it happen? I know you said Major League Baseball tried to stop it from happening. Did he just push them out of the way physically?
Yeah, what are you going to do? Hit him with the tranquilizer dart? What's that movie with Sean William Scott who gets hit with the tranquilizer dart?
Old school.
With Sean William Scott and Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
Is that what you're going to do?
Probably.
Really?
You detain him.
What does that mean? You cuff him?
I guess.
No.
Well, you can't.
People make their own decisions, and he made his bet. He's got to line it right now. You know, I really hope that nothing.
Well, you need more help from the Dodgers in that instance, right? And the Dodgers
weren't helping them.
Yeah, they weren't willing participants in this, I guess.
I found the whole post-game celebration to be bizarre to me.
I'm going to walk that take back. We have a rule on the show. You have till the end of a segment to walk a take back. I take back that they should have cuffed him. That seems implausible, and you're not going to do that at the height of celebration when you reach the summit that you've been working for, especially for that team, for so long. More is what I would recommend. They have to do more.
You walked back from handcuffs to more?
Yeah, they
That's
just
gotta be a
violation. No, not more than handcuffs. Just more than what they
did. I'm saying
did.
You have to walk it back to something else they should have done. Mm-hmm. You can't just say more. You should say walk back to lock them in a room, or walk it back to.
That's kidnapping. I think
no, it's not kidnapping.
That's not that has to go. That's a strong players union. That has to go against Major League Players Union protocol. I don't think you can get away with, you know, locking him in a supply closet like they did to Daniel Stern in Rookie of the Year. I don't think we can do that.
I think that what happened was he's a grown man, and he said he was going on the field. And what are you going to do? There's nothing. That's the end.
How about keep him away from your cancer surviving? How about keeping him away from your cancer surviving manager?
So, you know, you bring up a great question. It was a big team photo, and it's a big team. I'm not sure why Justin Turner wouldn't choose to be in the back, stand a little away, but he is the heart and soul of that team, and he wanted to be front and center, and I get it. I really do, except it just was so bad optically, and I hope no one gets sick. I hope Dave Roberts doesn't catch it, because without getting political, we know the odds are good that Justin Turner may test positive, may never have a symptom, and may be perfectly fine going forward. But there are people who are still getting sick. You just mentioned the Jaguars player who's in the hospital and has been twice. Is it really worth the risk? That's all I'm asking.
I want to talk to you about something a colleague at CBS said. I was watching your Champions League coverage, which bothers me a little bit because while the analysts are very good, there's a problem with the video feed. It is not clear enough. I mean, we're talking borderline standard def. And I know this is a problem with UEFA. I've done some reporting on this. UEFA, send a nicer feed. It's 2020. Everything should be in 4K by now. Everything. But Adam Schein was on after the Champions League coverage. And he said, and I know this is the business, that Clayton Kershaw is the greatest pitcher ever. At the very least, I'll give him greatest pitcher of his lifetime, but greatest pitcher ever, that's hot take-a-tude, right? Yeah, that's just saying something to make waves. Where do you stand on Clayton Kershaw's legacy?
I thought you were going to say, where do I stand on Adam Schein? And I would have gladly answered that. So I think that...
Where do you stand on Adam Schein?
I don't really have any interest in any of his takes of any kind, right? So I don't listen to them or pay attention to them
That's CBS on CBS crime. I don't know what the rule is there, but I know what the rule is here. You're in hot water with Adam Schein.
Listen, it is what it is. I think that people choose who they listen to and they choose where they get their takes from. I think there's plenty of examples on your network where people have takes just for the purpose of having takes.
Our network, we invented that. Yes.
But by the way, that's what I'm saying about Adam Schein, that very often it's takes for the purpose of takes. And that is a formula that has worked for many people on your network. And it's worked for many people. It's been copied by many people. And it's something that I take offense to, because then I get washed up like the baby thrown out with the bathwater. I'm never going to give you a take on nothing personal just for the purpose of having a take. That I wouldn't insult my audience that way. And what bothers me is it's insulting to the audience. And that's what I think that Adam does. And I think that many people in your shop do as well, by the way, who they're gas bags.
Right.
And they're
right.
Basically saying stuff because they've got so many minutes and hours of programming to fill that they get the trending topic of the day. And then they just have to give an opinion on it that is totally asinine. Mm-hmm. And they get raises for it. Yeah. Not that I'm bitter about that, but it's unbelievable to me.
Right. We kind of parody that with Stu Gatz. We use him as a vessel to hold the mirror up to the industry when he says ridiculous things like Kevin Durant doesn't have any titles in my personal record book. That's a rib on what's going on right now. Layered comedy. We're smarter than we get credit for.
Yeah, that's not a take, right? And you know what's funny? In my mentions on Twitter, there have been more and more people who are saying sometimes when I do something, there's a lot of Stu Gatz in me. What are people, what do they mean by that? Is it a look because we're both small with dark hair?
No, everybody's got a little Sugats in them is when someone's highlighting your hypocrisy in an instance, because Sugats will be the kind of guy that he did this yesterday. He was railing on Daniel Jones and Saquon Barkley for being photographed at a restaurant without wearing masks. But he's the same guy that has in the calendar right now three consecutive weekends traveling to lacrosse tournaments in Maryland and in Delaware, which may force him to quarantine for 14 days. So when someone says there's a little Sugats in everyone, it's hypocrisy.
So hypocrisy is one of the eight sins, because it is unavoidable. And we're not talking hypocrisy when we're talking about takes in sports media. And by the way, it's same as hot takes in the political media. So this is not just reserved for sports. There's hot takes in the business media. When you watch CNBC or you watch other networks like that, people love the hot take because they think it gets them attention and clicks and viewers and listeners. And it just makes me crazy. Clayton Kershaw is a phenomenal left-handed pitcher, a certain Hall of Famer. No question about it. But to call him the greatest pitcher of all time is insulting to the greatest pitchers of all time. So you have to go back. He's not the greatest Dodger pitcher of all time. So forget the greatest baseball pitcher. He doesn't even get to be the greatest Dodger. So, and obviously I'm going to go with Sandy Koufax.
I thought you were going to go Darren Oliver.
Darren Oliver, that's funny. You associate him as a Dodgers pitcher. I associate him as a Major League Baseball pitcher. He played for so many teams.
Lefty specialist for you guys, was he not?
Oh, we had him. By the way, great guy, and he is a rubber arm. That expression, and it is hard because younger players have been brought up where they're on a pitch count from the time that they're 12 years old, and that actually impacts us as running a major league team because their arms get hurt when you overuse them. Jack McKean always said to me, just use them, keep using them. And he would go talk to little leagues and talk to parents. Parents of 12-year-olds, Mikey, are insane. They want their kids on these crazy pitch counts because they think that their kids are going to be big league baseball players.
I have breaking news. Darren Oliver never played. Oh, nope. He played for the Angels, not the LA Dodgers. Maybe I was confusing him with Darren Dreyfuss. Very different pitchers.
By the way, they're different in almost every way.
yeah.
Other than their first name.
Yeah. Well, that's what I did there. I just figured Darren Oliver played for the Marlins? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Darren Oliver, I thought, played for everybody. But most famously, the Rangers, the Cardinals, the LA Angels. He played for you guys. Yeah.
So I'm not going to get caught because there's so many players who played for us over the years that I forget about half of them.
2004. He was a midseason acquisition, or he started the year with you guys and then you guys traded him to Houston. Either way, he wasn't with you for a full season.
He was very nice, as I recall.
He also had a 6.44 ERA for you guys. Oh, he was a starter for you guys. Long reliever, spot starter.
That's what he was. He's a swing guy.
What a career, 20-year career. You know how hard it is, especially in that era? Because you'll look around and you'll see Rene Latchman hung on the major leagues, even though he was hitting .209. To be able to have a 20-year career from 1993 to 2013, as analytics get in there, that's really impressive.
Take a look at Oliver Perez if you're looking at players who you cannot imagine how long they've been playing and how many teams. And Edwin Jackson is another example.
I like what you're doing right now. We're doing the Predator meme. You've seen the Predator meme? All right, so it's Arnold's arm and Carl Weathers' arm, and they're doing the flex handshake, and they meet in the middle. So it's Darren Oliver. Darren Dreyfuss is Arnold's arm. Oliver Perez is Carl Weathers' arm, and Darren Oliver meets in the middle.
Okay.
Look at that.
I find that to be compelling radio.
Okay, you're being sarcastic. I
think the Predator mem. I'm not a mem guy. I got to learn to be a mem guy. I'm trying to be hipper and more cool. I just learned that it's a GIF, not a GIF.
Yeah, well, either is fine. And people don't want to hear that. The creator says it's pronounced GIF, but you can pronounce it GIF. No harm, no foul. Let's everybody relax. There's an actual creator? Yeah. And the G in GIF, which gets people so upset, is because it stands for graphics. You're not calling it graphics. So that's why everyone gets upset. But either is fine. You shouldn't get upset about either. I've found that the people that call it GIF get really offended when you call it GIF, and the people that call it GIF when they hear GIF don't really care.
Are you telling me that there's one person who invented that entire cottage industry of GIFs?
Yeah, let me find out the name. Who?
That's pretty impressive.
Who invented
GIF? Does he have the rights to them? Does he get paid every time someone uses one? How did he monetize this?
Steve Wilhite. He created the GIF in 1987.
1987? I thought it was created for Twitter.
No, it just popularized it.
You know what?
Steve Wilhite, thank you. Yeah.
You know what I was doing in 1987? I was a freshman in college.
Yeah, you were hollering at your summer camp counselor. That's what you were doing.
At that time I wasn't hollering. I was doing way better stuff than that.
My man. All right, what's your Oliver Perez story as we wrap up here?
No, just that that's another example of a guy who's not a superstar, but he finds a roster spot year after year after year, and you need players like that on your team. And when you're putting a team together, when we sign Darren Oliver, you sign him as he's an insurance policy. If you have an injury, he can slot in and start. If you need him to go seven innings because of an extra innings game or because your starter only went a third of an inning, you can pitch him back to back to back. He's a veteran. You don't care about his arm. He knows how to take care of it, and you just keep pitching him. And if you can do that, and so when parents are trying to teach their kids how to become big league athletes, not everyone is going to be Mookie Betts. But that doesn't mean you can't be a professional baseball player. You're just not going to be an all-star and a Hall of Famer. Darren Oliver is a great example. Oliver Perez is a great example. They are the cream of the cream. They're in the top 0.01% of baseball players in the world, and we look at them like they're crap.
If you were raising a child and you raise them with the intention, a horrible intention, of making them a professional baseball player, what is the one skill that you would teach them to ensure they get to the majors quickly and have a nice long career because it's so in demand?
Thank you for asking that. And I would teach them, having nothing to do with being on the baseball field, I would teach them to understand what it is to fail. Baseball is the biggest game of failure there is, and the majority of athletes who don't make it to the majors make it because of their head, not their physical skills, that they cannot stand and deal with. They don't know how to mentally deal with failure.
Slow start to this week, but that's my mistake because I asked you about horror movies when famously you don't watch horror movies. That's my bad. We got into some really good stuff about Mike Hill and the World Series. Illuminating. You taught me things I didn't know. Speaking of, what is your review of the week?
So we have to talk about Billy Corbin.
537 votes.
I'm going to do it. I watched 537 votes. I'm going to do a longer review toward Election Day on Nothing Personal. But I just want to shout out on this show, because Billy Corbin is a friend of the show. And I think that people may not understand what a great filmmaker he is. And I knew everybody in that movie I dealt with when I got to Miami in 2002 and going forward, other than Roger Stone. Everyone else. And when I look at it, the way he put it together, he put it together in a way that the light bulb went off. It wasn't me the whole time who was crazy trying to get public money. It was them. And all I did was take advantage of exactly what Billy Corbin put on video in his movie. The absolute joke that is Miami politics. And unfortunately, Billy Corbin is now popular enough and good enough that it's going to be seen far and wide. And my take on the movie preliminarily is I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed to be a Miamian.
To be a South Floridian. Look at that. Interesting. Interesting that you can separate the art from the artist, too, when it comes to Billy Corbin.
Oh, big time. He's a great. And I actually texted him after. He didn't respond because normally he responds with GIFs with the middle finger out. But I texted him after that said that no matter what anyone says about you, you are a damn good filmmaker. And he basically said to screw off. But I love the guy. I mean, I love his talent. It is a hard thing to do, to put a movie together the way he did. And if you haven't seen it, you should. And the reason I want to get into more detail, it'll be like a 7 or 8 minute segment on Nothing Personal, is that there's some lessons in 537 that are very informative. And that's 20 years ago. And it's very interesting to look and see what's changed over 20 years in terms of voter suppression, in terms of the desire by one party versus the other to not get the vote out versus getting the vote out, versus how people are elected into jobs down ballot that no one cares about, but down ballot people, and now you got me started, but I'm going to stop. Down ballot people can change your life, and people don't get that.
As a big thank you to David Sampson, I just want to say for the audience, there is really nothing in it for David to be joining us every week outside of just mentioning his podcast. No matter how busy he is, and this is a busy time for him during the World Series, no matter what's going on personally, he's always here, even when it's not Dan, because it was once Dan, and then it was the shipping container, and now it's just me. I deeply appreciate you taking the time out, being this content fountain for us here on the Local Hour, week in and week out. Please support David Sampson by checking out his podcast, Nothing Personal with David Sampson. Really good stuff there. The Major League Baseball stuff was outstanding, and I'm sure he'll have more of that on his podcast. Be sure to support David. David, we'll talk to you next week.
All right, take care. Be safe. Thanks, Mikey.